act of curiosity about distant places, a considerable tolerance for habits that he discovered that were different from those of Greece, all of the apparatus that one would expect and hope from a person whose travels reflected the extent to which the classical world was not entirely bound within severe limits. Herodotus also, however, illustrates some of the continuing limitations of interregional contacts. His travels took him to Egypt. His travels took him to parts of the Middle East. His travels took him at least toward the western reaches of Central Asia. But this is not a huge network. No reason to downplay him. It's very venturesome by the standards of the time. But by the standards that would be established by a next series of travelers in the next world history period, this is interesting, promising, but a little bit modest. Equally revealing was the extent to which Herodotus and some other early travelers or people who were echoing the comments of travelers, the extent to which Herodotus was willing to mix absolute fancifulness and nonsense with solid fact. He visited a number of societies. He often proved to be a good observer, but he was extremely credulous about what people told him about that society over the next hill. Particularly, he loved to exaggerate sexual peculiarities, anatomical peculiarities, and his mixture of sober account and invention reveals what might be argued to be a sort of logical first stage of interregional travel that matches the tentativeness of commercial outreach that we've already described. Other travelers developed later in the classical period, particularly important right at the end of the classical period, was a significant series of Chinese travelers moving into Central Asia and particularly into India, where they, among other things, often sought Buddhist sanctuary, Buddhist inspiration. These travelers would help expand Chinese knowledge of a world beyond Chinese boundaries and, again, illustrate the extent to which the classical world was not entirely confined to the major civilizations themselves. A second kind of contact, beyond travel and trade, emerged through two direct encounters between major civilizations themselves, and one might add a third. Encounter number one, reasonably well known, at least from the Greek standpoint in terms of Greek history, involved the encounter in the 6th and early 5th centuries BCE between Greece and Persia. Many Greeks learned quite a bit about Persian society. Some Greeks, like Herodotus, argued that Persians learned quite a bit about Greek society in what was a really unusual situation in which two major societies operating on somewhat different cultural and institutional bases had direct territorial and military interaction with each other, with some mutual learning resulting, and certainly a good bit of mutual antagonism. Beyond this, and in some ways extending it, Alexander the Great's conquest brought Greek civilization not only into more elaborate contact with societies and cultures in the Middle East, including Persia, but on into northwestern India. Here, emissaries from Hellenistic society, Greeks themselves, and other Middle Easterners who were interacting with Hellenistic values, Hellenistic representatives interacted directly with representatives of Indian culture with several interesting but arguably also surprisingly limited results. Most obvious was an artistic interaction that followed this period of Hellenistic Indian contact and lasted for probably about 150 years. In this contact, Greek artistic styles and costumes were utilized by Indian and Central Asian artists to represent, among other things, the figure of the Buddha and other figures associated with Buddhism. So there are interesting depictions of the Buddha with Greek hairstyles, Greek clothing styles, Greek artistic apparatus, and it's an intriguing example of the potency of contact in which two societies both maintain a certain degree of separation, i.e., these are Greek styles but Indian religion, but also manage to combine them in an imaginative combination or synthesis. Equally important, however, this stylistic fusion didn't last too long, doesn't have clear echo because by the end of the Hellenistic period, this kingdom had dissolved, and the Greek-Indian interaction dissolved with it. Another facet of this interaction, which almost certainly occurred but we don't know full dimensions, involves the extent to which Greek and Indian mathematicians exchanged ideas. Both societies had developed advanced mathematics, each had a somewhat distinctive set of experiences, and as far as we can determine, there was some active interest on both parts in using this point of contact for what we might view as an early version of scientific exchange. On the other hand, not only is our knowledge of exactly what was passed around limited, but one of the most obvious, in retrospect, possibilities for transmission did not occur. Greeks did not pick up through this conversation the Indian number system, which was vastly superior to the Greek system and which would be adopted in the West only after it had much later been transmitted to the Arabs and thence to the Western world. So again, patterns here seem to be interesting, intriguing, but surprisingly limited, suggesting that even when two civilizations encountered each other directly, there was some hesitation about borrowing too much. Other possible results of this Greek-Indian interaction include the possibility that it was Alexander's inspiration, his intrusion politically and militarily into India, that helped inspire later Indian leaders to begin greater political and imperial activity on their own, leading initially to the Mauryan dynasty, the first great Indian imperial episode. That's an interesting possible ramification, but not exactly a connection in the sense of active ongoing contact or imitation. It's also possible that fueled by this contact, some Buddhist missionaries were sent into the Middle East, where possibly, although they did not seem to generate many, if any, direct conversions to Buddhism, possibly there was some interaction with Middle Eastern thinking, Middle Eastern ethical thought in ways that would later fuel Western movements like Stoicism, and through them even possibly some aspects of Christianity. But this is speculative. We simply don't have the records. We don't know how far to press this contact. A final contact, and a much better established one, we know more about it among other things, a final contact began to take shape in the early centuries CE directly between China and India. Chinese merchants obviously had developed interest in Indian connections. Chinese travelers began to report not just on Indian religion, but on the prosperity of Indian society. And a fairly steady trickle of Chinese visitors began to pour down into the subcontinent from the 2nd and 3rd centuries CE onward. From their activities, and sometimes as a direct intention behind their activities, China began to import Buddhism directly from India, along with Buddhist artistic styles, Buddhist literature, in a pattern of exchange, a really unusual pattern of exchange for the classical period that ushered in a significant alteration in Chinese history for several centuries. This actually, until the past century plus, is the only significant case of fairly deliberate and extensive Chinese involvement with a foreign cultural import in ways that would interact with the Chinese mainstream. Large numbers of upper class and ordinary Chinese converted to Buddhism, interest in replicating Buddhist prayers, in translating Buddhist religious literature, ran high in China, and it's an intriguing episode. Also intriguing, and this frankly is not a qualification on the importance of this contact, also intriguing is the extent to which the contact had to be mediated by a corresponding effort to make sure that the Buddhism that was imported in ways that were consistent with Chinese value systems. Two points of sinification of making Buddhism Chinese were particularly significant. First, Chinese insistence helped persuade many Buddhist leaders in China of the importance of combining their genuine Buddhism with a very explicit acknowledgement of the importance of the Chinese state and the legitimacy of the Chinese emperor. In other words, Buddhism by Chinese values, particularly Confucian values, could seem slightly risky if it was allowed to retain its emphasis on purely religious goals, on otherworldly contemplation, and it could be brought into greater harmony if some explicit statements of political loyalty could be added in. The other adjustment is actually in many ways more intriguing, not less expected, but more intriguing. That was the extent to which, under Chinese influence, the Buddhism that flowed into China was modified to place greater emphasis on what today we might call family values. Buddhism, in its pure form, valued celibacy. Buddhism tended to emphasize individual spiritual quests in which the family might be deliberately downplayed or even abandoned. And this did not sit well with the Confucian view of social propriety. So many Buddhist statements about women, about family obligations, were significantly redone in the effort to make this pattern more recognizable, more harmonious with Chinese values. This is an indication, obviously, that exchanges between civilizations were going to be complicated, which is totally unsurprising. It's an indication that serious exchanges, and this was one, serious exchanges would involve what we sometimes call symbiosis, that is, a combination of the imported value system with important beliefs and practices from the receiving society in a syncretic fashion. This is an illustration, then, of a kind of combination that during the classical period itself was frankly fairly rare. What does this add up to? The stories are intriguing. Herodotus is a really interesting traveler. His account is well worth reading, both the accurate parts and the fanciful parts. The stories of the Silk Road trade are endlessly enthralling because, again, they're shrouded in mystery. They cover long distances. They cover societies in which civilization and nomadism intermingle to a certain extent. All of this is great stuff. But as I've tried to indicate, it's important to realize that for the classical period itself, these patterns of contact and exchange were not peripheral, but minor chord in the history of the period itself. The basic stuff of classical history continues to be the focus on the individual civilizations, the areas immediately around them that they could affect through trade patterns and cultural exchanges, but not any sort of systematic interaction among the civilizations themselves. It's important to recognize that for most of the classical civilizations during most of the period, direct borders with other large organized civilizations were the exception rather than the rule. Greece abutted Persia. The expanded Roman Empire would also contact later Persian kingdoms and war with them. That was an active intercivilizational border. Persia and Indian kingdoms might have some direct contact in a familiar kind of geographical passage. But large stretches of the Roman Empire bordered on hunting and gathering or early agricultural societies, not on highly organized civilizations. Most of China's borders, with the exception of Korea and Vietnam, similarly involve contacts with nomadic peoples, not those of other civilizations. And the same applies to much of India. Classical history, obviously, remains a history in which contacts are an important but secondary story, despite our tendency to wish that they somehow counted for more. That said, I'll back up just briefly to insist as well that though the contacts were somewhat marginal in terms of the leading economic themes of the period within the major regions, although, with the exception really of the Chinese-Indian exchange, they didn't generate deep or durable cultural influences that touched more than one society, although they didn't clearly develop patterns of technological diffusion that were particularly extraordinary, the exchanges were significant enough that they would be remembered even after some of the apparatus of the classical period itself fell into disuse. The Silk Roads particularly had depended, obviously, on effective Chinese control of a territory that reached into Central Asia. They depended on some capacity to protect at least some of the traders and travelers along the Central Asian route. They depended very heavily on the significant organization of Persia that was first obtained in the Persian Empire and then revived by successor states, because utilizing the Persian road system, utilizing the system of inns and places of refuge that the Persian government had built, was a vital land route connection between Central Asia and the Middle East and on into the Mediterranean. So these routes were important, they were well established, and as they began to be challenged, they would be remembered and ultimately replacements would be sought. For the final stage of the story, in the classical period itself, is to recognize that as the classical societies began to decline, to suffer new levels of disorder, and that's the subject of our next session, familiar but in world history somewhat transformed account of the rise and fall of, as these organized classical civilizations began, at least for a time, to disintegrate, the importance of trade opportunities and possibly even the promise of cultural exchange remained vivid enough that people would actively seek replacements. And if the land route that had, for example, anchored the Silk Roads, if the land route became impassable, if government authority became too weak and enfeebled to guarantee the security of travelers around this route, there was, frankly, a pretty obvious alternative already sketched in the classical period itself, and that would be further, wider utilization of the Indian Ocean, a replacement, at least for a time, a replacement of land-based operations with sea trade, and that would help indeed usher in some key characteristics of the next period. So, the contact points in the classical period, well worth noting, they're an important if subsidiary part of the classical story. They don't overwhelm the greater dominance of factors operating within the civilizations, but they add a bit. But they did help set up a phase in which, in succeeding centuries after the classical period, new types of contact would be pursued, new levels of contact would develop, and the story would really take on a different coloration entirely.
Lecture 9. The Decline of the Classical Civilizations.
We're dealing today with one of the great divides in human history, the fall of the great classical empires. The fall of the Roman Empire has been the subject, obviously, of immense analysis and speculation, even beginning as the empire itself was falling. Needless to say, for those of you who are beginning to get tuned into world history, the fall of one empire, however significant, might not mark the end of a full world history period, but the fact is, the fall of the Roman Empire was joined in approximately the same chronological span by the fall of the Han Dynasty in China, and slightly later, the fall of the Gupta Empire in India. So we'll be looking at a process that actually has, if not global, at least Afro-Eurasian dimensions, involving significant changes, significant deterioration in some of the great structures that had been tossed up by the long classical period. The fall of the great empires obviously should not mask the fact that there had before, during the classical period, been some significant ups and downs. In the Mediterranean, the Greek city-states, Athens, Sparta, had reached an apogee at the end of the 5th century and then went into a period of decline. This was followed, of course, by the Hellenistic period, which itself would then decline about 200 years later. The Roman Republic rose and then declined, followed by the empire, so there were oscillations. The same thing applies to Indian history, with, for example, the fall of the Mauryan Empire, followed by a period of regional emphasis, then followed by the rise of the Guptas. Chinese classical history had been marked by the decline of the Zhou dynasty over a prolonged period. Again, oscillations. But these earlier oscillations all occurred within a framework that seemed to persist or at least revive, so that one can talk about change, but not some sort of systematic major termination to a period. The fall of the great classical empires, the subject today, is really different because we're talking about a significant alteration in political and, in many cases, economic and cultural structures, after which the world that would follow, still very interesting, still very vibrant in many respects, would really be measurably different from the dynamics of the classical period itself. There are, of course, three separate stories. The Han Dynasty was the first to go. It entered a period of greater weakness toward the end of the 2nd century CE, and there were even interruptions in Han rule itself. Economic conditions seemed to deteriorate. There was definitely rising social unrest, which in Chinese history usually signals a period in which landlords are acquiring greater power over the peasantry, increasing their exactions, and the central state, increasingly enfeebled, is unable to control their inroads. That obviously happened with the Han. A series of invasions from Central Asia, from a group that is broadly named the Hun, a series of invasions toppled the empire. That was the coup de grace, and the Han were no more after 220 CE. The story in Rome was a little bit more drawn out. The Roman Empire reached its high point around 180 CE. That was the point at which the empire had its greatest territorial dimensions. After 180, it became impossible for Rome to expand further, and as we discussed previously, when Rome stopped being able to expand, it was almost automatically in some trouble because it lost the means to supply new sources of labor and to reward generals. Decline was, however, gradual. We don't want to overdo it. But over time, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, and then finally in the 5th, on average, the quality of leadership in the empire deteriorated. Individual emperors were more likely to be inept than had been the case before. The army began to intervene more crudely in political affairs, naming emperors according to who would favor one or another factions in the army. Cultural life deteriorated. Original work tended to yield to copying efforts, textbooks. I personally hate to use textbooks as an example of intellectual decline, but the fact is if you're only generating summaries of established information, you're probably not in a deeply creative period. So cultural decline, with the key exception of the new work being done around Christianity, cultural decline in the literary and philosophical central points of Roman intellectual life was part of the picture. Economic decline was marked. The internal trading network that Rome had carefully established began to deteriorate in favor of more local economic emphases and efforts at self-sufficiency. Many agricultural estates tried to produce whatever they would need locally rather than relying on trade networks. Economic deterioration in this sense obviously also led to a worsening in taxation conditions. The central state found itself unable to collect as much tax revenue as it had been accustomed to, and this was something that would then feed political decline. You have clearly something of a vicious cycle that described a major reduction in the empire's ability to function. This was then followed by a period of increased invasion, particularly pressure from Germanic tribes on the northern border of the empire, pressing in by migration as well as invasion. But in one case, there was also a direct attack of the Huns, another group of Huns from Central Asia, who came into Italy, sacked Rome, and was bought off only by elaborate negotiations by the Roman papacy. Invasion, again, as in the case of the Han Dynasty, set the seal to imperial decline in Rome, but the process had been going on for a long time before this final blow. The Roman Empire officially ended, at least in the West, around 476 CE, but again, this was the culmination of decades, even centuries, in which the empire simply had stopped functioning as well as it had done at its high point. The case of India is frankly simpler. The Gupta Empire began to face a deterioration in operations in the 5th century. Emperors found themselves less able to control local rulers, another theme that we see in all three cases. So decentralization, even though there was still an emperor in name, decentralization began to occur. Local officials began to usurp the functions of the central government in terms of regulating local peasants, exacting taxes, etc. And then in the 6th century, CE, another set of invasions from Central Asia, again, another group of Huns, dislodged the empire altogether, and the Gupta Empire was no more. So we have three cases. They are not exactly tidy chronologically. The cases spread from the 3rd century to the 6th century CE, almost 400 years. But given the fact that the classical period had operated in terms of focus mainly on individual cases rather than some sort of coordinated whole, to have such similar developments occur this close together is taken by most world historians as an indication that you really can talk about some common processes and, as we will see, some common results, and use these cases to say, well, by 500, or yield a little bit in terms of the Gupta Empire, at least 600, the classical world is really gone. The coincidence in process, the fact that three magnificent empires found themselves less able to function, the qualities of central leadership deteriorated, local political and economic elements began to see center stage, economic performance stagnated, in some cases at least, increased social unrest would respond to worsening conditions, which could make the situation still worse in turn, and all of this capped by a series of invasions. This process has enough in common not only to mark the end of one of the major world history periods, and, as we will see also, the beginning of the next one, but also to stimulate tremendous discussion of what kinds of causes were involved, why these magnificent edifices could crumble as they did. Historians have debated these issues, particularly, frankly, focused on the fall of the Roman Empire. Historians have debated these issues for a very long time, and there are lots of candidates. At one point, there was speculation that somehow changes in climate, changes in basic environment were involved, and people wondered if there had been some sunspots or some other disaster in the wider environment that reduced the quality of harvests and disrupted economic activity. In the case of Rome, there was a long debate at the time, actually, and then it was again revived in the 18th century. There was a long debate as to whether the rise of Christianity was responsible for some sort of weakening of classic Roman virtues. Not necessarily anti-Christian, this argument could hold that Christianity, with its otherworldly, turn-the-other-cheek emphasis, while a vital and important addition to world history, was so different from the kinds of martial virtues that had organized the Roman Empire that this in itself was a cause of deterioration. These factors now are mainly put to the side in favor of three coincident emphases with regard to causation. First, quite obviously, in all three cases, invasion was a key factor. We don't quite know what turmoil in Central Asia, possibly population expansion, possibly internal rivalries, began to propel groups of Huns into patterns of migration and attack on the established empires, first in China, then in Europe and the northern Middle East, then finally in India. We don't quite know what propelled these attacks, but we certainly know they occurred.